Chapter 14. The Antechamber. There are beings and artifacts against which we batter our intelligence raw, and in the end, make peace with reality only by saying it was an apparition, a thing of beauty and horror. Somewhere among the swirling worlds I am so soon to explore, there lives a race like and yet unlike the human. They are no taller than we. Their bodies are like ours, save that they are perfect, and that the standard to which they adhere is wholly alien to us. Like us, they have eyes, a nose, a mouth. But they use these features, which are, as I have said, perfect, to express emotions we have never felt, so that for us to see their faces is to look upon some ancient and terrible alphabet of feeling, at once supremely important and utterly unintelligible. Such a race exists, yet I did not encounter it there at the edge of the gardens of the House Absolute. What I had seen moving among the trees, and what I now, until I at last saw it clearly, flung myself toward, was rather the giant image of such a being kindled to life. Its flesh was of white stone, and its eyes had the smoothly rounded blindness, like sections cut from eggshells we see in our own statues. It moved slowly, like one drugged or sleeping, yet not unsteadily. It seemed sightless, yet it gave the impression of awareness, however slow. I have just paused to reread what I have written of it, and I see that I have failed utterly to convey the essence of the thing. Its spirit was that of sculpture. If some fallen angel had overheard my conversation with the green man, he might have contrived such an enigma to mock me. In its every movement it carried the serenity and permanency of art and stone. I felt that each gesture, each position of the head and limbs and torso might be the last, or that each might be repeated interminably, as the poses of the gnomons of Valeria's many-faceted dial were repeated down the curving corridors of the instants. My initial terror, after the white statue's strangeness had washed away my will toward death, was the instinctive one that it would do me hurt. My second was that it would not attempt to. To be as frightened as something as I was of that silent, inhuman figure, and then to discover that it meant no harm, would have been unbearably humiliating. Forgetting for a moment the ruin it would bring her blade to strike that living stone, I drew Terminus Est and reined in the black. The breeze itself seemed to pause as we stood there, the black hardly quivering, myself with sword upraised, as still almost ourselves as statues. The real statue came toward us, its three or four times life-size face stamped with inconceivable emotion, and its limbs wrapped in terrible and perfect beauty. I heard Jonas shout and the sound of a blow. I had just time to see him on the ground, grappling with men in tall crested helmets that vanished and reappeared even as I looked at them, when something whizzed past my ear. Another struck my wrist, and I found myself struggling in a web of cords that constricted like little boas. Someone seized my leg and pulled, and I fell. When I had recovered enough to be aware of what was taking place, I had a wire noose about my neck, and one of my captors was rummaging through my sabretache. I could see his hands clearly, darting like brown sparrows. His face was visible, too, an impassive mask that might have been suspended above me on a conjurer's threat. Once or twice as he moved, the extraordinary armor he wore gleamed. Then I saw it as one sees a crystal beaker immersed in clear water. It was reflective, I think, burnished beyond any merely human skill, so that its own material was invisible and only the greens and browns of the wood could be seen, twisted by the shapes of cuirass, gorget, and greaves. Despite my protest that I was a member of the guild, the Praetorian took all the money I had, though he left me Thecla's brown book, my fragment of whetstone, oil and flannel, and the other miscellaneous objects in my sabertash. Then he skillfully drew off the cords that entangled me and thrust them, as nearly as I could tell, into the armhole of his breastplate, though not before I had seen them. They reminded me of the whip we used to call a cat, and were a bundle of thongs joined at one end and weighted at the other. I had learned since that this weapon is called the achico. My captor now lifted the wire noose until I stood. I was conscious, as I have been on several similar occasions, that we were in some sense playing a game. We were pretending that I was totally in his power, when in fact I might have refused to rise, until he had either strangled me or called over some of his comrades to carry me. I could have done several other things as well. Seized the wire and tried to wrest it from him, struck him in the face. I might have escaped, been killed, been rendered unconscious, or plunged into agony, but I could not actually be forced to do as I did. At least I knew it was a game, and I smiled as she sheathed Terminus Est and led me to where Jonas stood. Jonas said, "We've done no harm. Return my friend's sword and give us back our animals and we will go." There was no reply. In silence, two Praetorians, four fluttering sparrows, as it seemed, caught our destriers and led them away. How like us those animals were. Walking patiently, they knew not where, their massive heads following thin strips of leather. 9/10 of life, so it seems to me, consists of these surrenders. We were made to go with our captors out of the wood and onto a rolling meadow that soon became a lawn. The statue walked after us, and others of his kind joined him, until there were a dozen or more, all huge, all different, and all beautiful. I asked Jonas who the soldiers were and where they were taking us, but he did not answer, and I was nearly throttled for my pains. So far as I could tell, they were armored from head to foot, yet the perfect polish of the metal imparted to it a seeming softness, an almost liquid yielding, that was profoundly disturbing to the eye, and that permitted it to fade into sky and grass at a distance of a few paces. When we had walked half a league across the sward, we entered a grove of flowering plums, and at once the crested helms and flaring pauldrons danced with pink and white. There we struck a path that curved and curved again. Just as we were on the point of emerging from the grove, we halted, and Jonas and I were pushed violently back. I heard the feet of the stony figures that followed us grate on the gravel as they too stopped short. One of the soldiers warned them off with what seemed to me a wordless cry. I peered through the blossoms as well as I could to see what lay ahead. Before us was a walk much broader than the one we trod. It was, in fact, a garden path, grown until it had become a magnificent processional way. The pavement was of white stone, and marble balustrades flanked it to either side. Down it marched a motley company. Most were on foot, but some rode beasts of various sorts. One led a shaggy arctother, another perched upon the neck of a ground sloth, greener than the lawns. No sooner had this group passed than other groups followed them. While they were still too far for me to distinguish their faces, I noticed one in which the bowed head of a single individual was lifted above the rest by at least 3 cubits. A moment later, I had recognized another as Dr. Talos, strutting along with his chest thrown out and his head well back. My own dear Dorcas followed close behind him, looking more than ever like a forlorn child, wandered from some higher sphere. Fluttering with veils and sparkling with bijou under her parasol, Jolenta rode a diminutive jennet side saddle, and behind them all, patiently wheeling such properties as he could not shoulder, lumbered he whom I had identified first, the giant, Baldanders. If it was painful for me to see them pass without being able to call out, it must have been torment for Jonas. When Jolenta was nearly opposite us, she turned her head. To me, at that moment, it seemed she must have winded his desire, as among the mountains, certain unclean spirits are said to be attracted by the odor of meat that has been cast upon a fire for them. No doubt, it was really only the flowering trees among which we stood that caught her attention. I heard the inhalation of Jonas's breath, but the first syllable of her name was cut short by the thud of the blow that followed, and he pitched at my feet. When I recall that scene now, the rattle of his metal hand on the gravel path is as vivid as the perfume of the plum blossoms. After all the troops of performers had gone, two Praetorians picked up poor Jonas and carried him. They did it as easily as they might have carried a child, but I at the time attributed that only to their strength. We crossed the road down which the performers had come and penetrated a hedge of roses higher than a man, covered with immense white blossoms and filled with nesting birds. Beyond it lay the gardens proper. If I should try to describe them, I should seem only to have borrowed the mad stammering eloquence of Hedor. Every hill and tree and flower seemed to have been arranged by some master intelligence, which I have since learned is that of Father Anir, to form a breathtaking vision. The observer feels that he is at the center, that everything he sees has been directed toward the point at which he stands. But after he had walked 100 paces or a league, he finds himself at the center still. And every vision seems to convey some incommunicable truth, like one of the unutterable insights granted eremites. So beautiful were these gardens that we had been in them for some time before I realized that no towers were lifted above them. Only the birds and the clouds, and beyond them, the old sun and the pale stars, rose higher than their treetops. We might have been wandering through some divine wilderness. Then we reached the crest of a wave of land more lovely than any cobalt wave of Ouroboros's, and with breathtaking suddenness, a pit opened at our feet. I have called it a pit, but it was not at all like the dark abyss usually associated with that word. Rather, it was a grotto filled with fountains and night flowers, and dotted with people more brilliant than any flowers. People who loitered beside its waters and gossiped among its shades. At once, as though a wall had collapsed to let light into a tomb, many of the memories of the House Absolute, mine by absorption now from the life of Thecla, coalesced. I understood something that had been implicit in the Doctor's play and in many of the stories Thecla had told me as well, though she had never mentioned it directly. The whole of this great palace lay underground, or rather its roofs and walls were heaped with soil planted and landscaped so that we had been walking all this time over the seat of the Autarch's power, which I had thought still some distance away. We did not go down into that grotto, which no doubt opened onto chambers quite unsuited to the detention of prisoners, or into any of the next score or so we passed. At last, however, we came upon one far more grim, though no less beautiful. The stair by which we entered it had been carved to resemble a natural formation of dark rock, irregular and sometimes treacherous. Water dripped from above, and ferns and dark ivy grew in the upper parts of this artificial cavern, where a little sunlight still found its way. In the lower regions, 1,000 steps down, the walls were studded with blind fungi. Some of these were luminous. Some strewed the air with strange, musty odors. Some suggested fantastic phallic fetishes. In the center of this dark garden, supported by scaffolding and green with verdigris, hung a set of gongs. It appeared to me that they were intended to be rung by the wind, yet it seemed impossible that any wind should ever reach them. So I thought, at least until one of the Praetorians opened a heavy door of bronze and worm-scarred wood in one of the dark stone walls. Then a draft of cold, dry air blew through that doorway and set the gongs to swaying and clashing, so well-tuned that their chiming seemed the purposeful composition of some musician whose thoughts were now in exile here. In looking up at the gongs, which the Praetorians did not prevent me from doing, I saw the statues, 40 at least, who had followed us all the way across the gardens. They now rimmed the pit, motionless at last, and looked down on us like a frieze of cenotaphs. I had expected to be the only occupant of a small cell, I suppose because I unconsciously transferred the practices of our own oubliette to this unknown place. Nothing more different from the actual arrangement could have been imagined. The entrance opened on no corridor of narrow doors, but to a spacious and carpeted one, with a second entrance opposite. Hastarii with flaming spears stood as sentries before the second set of doors. At a word from one of the Praetorians, they swung them open. Beyond lay a vast, shadowy, bare room with a very low ceiling. Several dozen persons, men and women, and a few children, were scattered in diverse parts of it, most singly, but some in couples or groups. Families occupied alcoves, and in some places, screens of rags had been erected to provide privacy. Into this we were thrust. Or rather, I was thrust, and the unfortunate Jonas was thrown. I tried to catch him as he fell, and I at least prevented his head from striking the floor. As I did so, I heard the door slam shut behind me.